So I'm going to be talking about progressive realization and its connection to international development goals, and focusing specifically on the right to water. So I have no disclosures. So as a quick roadmap, I want to talk briefly about progressive realization and how it fits within the human rights framework, to rights in general, and then specifically to the right to water. Look at some international development goals with universal access and MDGs, and then I want to focus specifically on a case out of South Africa called Mazibuko and Others versus the City of Johannesburg, and then I'll mention briefly some issues moving forward. So as already been stated, these are sort of the main documents for the general human rights framework, and I'm going to be focusing specifically on the Covenant for Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, though there are many others. So first, what is progressive realization? It comes out of the economic, social, and cultural rights, and it states that a state has to take steps individually and through international assistance and cooperation, especially economic and technical, to the maximum of its available resources with a view to achieving progressively the full realization of rights recognized in the present covenant by all appropriate means, including particularly the adoption of legislative measures. And so if you look at then the next quote and see that civil and political rights, so the next quote is civil and political rights, where it says to respect and to ensure to all individuals the rights recognized in the present covenant. So you can see there's a distinction between the two. One is to eventually realize it fully and just to show that you're progressively working towards that, whereas civil and political rights have to be achieved immediately. So some people have tried to figure out what the distinction is, and a lot of times the main mention is positive and negative rights. So with civil and political, it's more saying that the government does not have, they cannot sort of infringe on your rights. For example, the right to vote, it's just passing a legislation and then the government is not supposed to impose. Whereas a lot of times positive rights require the government to take active steps to fulfill that right. And so the focus then is on the resource demands. Positive rights require the states to put in time and resources. But I mentioned two examples, the right to liberty and security, and then reproductive rights, to show that this distinction is kind of misleading and a lot of times inaccurate. So the right to liberty and security is a civil and political right, but to fully realize this, the government has to work on judicial systems, they have to upkeep prisons, they have to implement law enforcement. Whereas reproductive rights, a lot of times it's more a lot of people don't want the government infringing on, for example, things like abortion rights and right to reproductive care. So here's the general comment that sort of expands some of the rights or the obligations of states. And it talks specifically about a minimum core for certain rights that the government is supposed to provide. So the government here says that they have to provide a minimum core for certain rights, to take necessary steps to maximize to the maximum of available resources, and for a state to demonstrate that every effort has been made to fulfill these rights. But again, there's still issues. One, with the minimum core, there's difficulty in trying to figure out what exactly it means, who decides what it is, and whether it's enforceable. And then you see that there's still mention of resources, and so there's still that idea of progressive realization and resources limiting. So again here, with General Comment 14, you see that a state party cannot, under any circumstances whatsoever, justify non-compliance with the core obligations. But in determining which actions or omissions amount to a violation of, say, the right to health, it's important to distinguish the inability from the unwillingness. And so again, by putting in that sort of inability, it's still focusing on resources and what the state can do, not only what it actually is doing. And so the issue then is by seeing this progressive realization, does it actually matter? And I think that it does. And I want to use the right to water as an example. So first, let's go through sort of the evolution of the right to water. It was mentioned in the previous one, so I don't want to go too into depth. But as you can see, General Comment 15 incorporated the right to water through economic, social, and cultural rights, saying mainly that it's a prerequisite for the realization of these rights. So focusing on the Millennium Development Goal 7.C, the goal was to halve the proportion of the population without sustainable access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation by 2015. And between 1990 and 2012, 2.3 billion people gained access to improved drinking water sources. And so they finished ahead of schedule for drinking water. Of course, I sort of put improved in italics because some people have argued whether that is important and whether that's what should be measured. A lot of times that means that the focus is on a service provided, so just an improvement over the service, not actually seeing what the outcome is and what people are actually getting from it. So more bad news is that in 2012, nearly 800 million were still without access to improved sources of drinking water, and 2.5 billion still lacked access to improved sanitation. Again, or even more problematic is that over 1 billion people still practice open defecation, and nearly 90% of this is in rural areas. And the practice has actually been increasing since 1990 in sub-Saharan Africa. And so especially looking at the open defecation, it's one of the reasons that some people say that it's problematic just to focus on drinking water specifically and focus on just improved drinking water sources. Because what counts, or what could count as improved drinking water sources includes household connections, boreholes, protected dug wells, protected springs, or rainwater collection systems. And so one of those could be implemented into a certain area, while at the same time, if there's no improved sanitation, open defecation could actually impact the water that would be coming out on the other end or how it would actually be consumed. So here's some other sort of health problems that are related to water. Approximately 1.9 million deaths per year in children under age of 5 are caused by diarrhea-related illnesses. Diarrhea specifically is one of the main causes of morbidity and mortality for children around the world. And so unsafe drinking water also connects to other diseases. So there's enteric fever, cholera, polio, hepatitis A and E. And then it's also connected to schistosomiasis, which in itself causes tens of thousands of deaths a year. And then a lot of times also for those who don't die, there can be issues with water-related illnesses that impact normal growth, physical fitness, cognitive function, and often there's high-intensity intestinal parasitic infections that are extremely problematic. So this is not to say that, you know, there haven't been advances and they're not great and they're not noteworthy, but I think it's also important to put it into its evolutionary context. So the 1977 Water Conference, which was mentioned before, they passed a resolution, and the goal was to provide universal access to drinking water and sanitation by 1990. And so we're almost 40 years later. We actually lowered the standard of what we wanted to do, and we still didn't actually achieve the goal that we set out. And so when you look at it that way, I think it starts to seem a little bit more problematic. And again, it's not to say that the advances aren't great, but that maybe we should be pushing ourselves a little bit more. And it also begs the question of why aren't we advancing more in this amount of time? And I think the progressive realization and its impact on the law specifically is one of the main reasons. And so for that, I want to use this case to show why. So Johannesburg was having a problem with water waste and not recouping enough funds. And so they decided to implement these prepaid water meters in a town called Soweto, which is one of the poorer and primarily black areas of Johannesburg. And they implemented the meters, and they provided 6,000 liters of free water per month per household. And that was for everyone in the city regardless. So that's, if you have a prepaid meter, if you don't have one, you get 6,000 liters of free water per month. So the problem with that is that for some people, obviously, the wealthy, they're still getting the free water. You know, I mean, they might use more, but at the same time, they still don't have to pay for that. So they thought this was just the best and easiest and most administratively efficient way to do it. But a suit was filed, because even those that were getting free ones, if they didn't have a prepaid water meter, they had a credit meter. And so you could get as much water as you want, and it just builds credit, and you have to pay on the back end. Whereas if you have a prepaid one, after the 6,000 runs out, your water completely disconnects unless you have paid ahead of time. So this suit was over not fulfilling the constitutional right to water and also discriminatory uses of the prepaid meters. So the South African Constitutional Court, which is one of the most progressive and rights-driven constitutions in the world, says everyone has the right to have access to water. The state must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to achieve progressive realization of these rights. So again, you see, this is directly international documents, progressive realization, being implemented into country constitutions. And what this case shows is that it has an actual impact on people. So with no international court to sort of appeal to, which was discussed earlier, these people who had a problem with it have to go to their local courts. The two lower courts ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, though on different terms. So the initial lower court said that there was a basic minimum of 50 liters per person per day that had to be provided by the state, and that the prepaid water meters had no legal basis and were procedurally unfair. Then the appellate court held that a basic minimum of 42 liters per person per day had to be provided by the state. And they also said that the meters were problematic, but they put it on a two-year hold to allow the state time to implement changes. And so I also put up the WHO, just to sort of put in context, the 42 liters and 50 liters. 25 is what they say is the absolute minimum for consumption. And then 50 is what they say is the basic minimum, what you need for sanitation, food preparation, bathing, and consumption. So the Constitution, it ultimately went up to the highest court in South Africa, the Constitutional Court, and they did not agree with the lower courts. So they said that the state does not require, or the Constitution does not require the state upon demand to provide every person with sufficient water, which seems contradictory to what the Constitution says, that they have to provide sufficient water. And so largely their basis was that there are limited resources and that the court itself is not in position to make a determination on how to use those limited resources. So a lot of what they talked about was this sort of idea of democratic accountability. Judges aren't elected, the executive and the legislature are. So with limited resources, it's up to them to make a determination how much water to use, who to give it to, how to give it to people. And they flatly rejected any right to a basic core minimum, and they found most of the state's arguments for sort of the prepaid water meter system persuasive and upheld basically all of them. So in actual terms, what does this mean? So again, the prepaid water meters provided 6,000 liters per month per household. So it makes no determination based on how many people are in the household. And in poorer areas, a lot of times there's a lot more people in the house. A lot of times they'll have a plot of land and they'll actually build shacks in the backyards and rent those out. And so the people that sued were in this area called Fieri, which is actually even poorer. It's a poorer part of Soweto. And the average household there is 13 people. One of the plaintiffs that sued, I think they actually had 20 people on their plot. So if you do the math, 13 people in a household, 6,000 liters per month, that means if you use the shortest month, 28 days, that averages out to 16.5 liters per person per day for that month, which is below the WHO basic minimum just for consumption alone. Now again, in wealthier areas, I think I read that the average household is somewhere between 3 and 4 people, or give or take. And they are also still getting the 6,000 liters free. So those people are getting essentially 3 to 4 times as much free water per person per day, which is actually over the basic minimum. And then if they want to go over that, they would just have to pay. Other problems that were pointed out were that The wealthier citizens, obviously, they had credit meters, and so theirs isn't cut off ahead of time, and there are actually procedural protections in place. So some of the procedural protections that had to be undertaken before their water could be cut off were that they had to get a final demand notice, there had to be opportunity to reach an agreement with the council for payment within 14 days of that final notice, and there had to be hand delivering or posting of the final discontinuation notice. So, again, some other problems are the head of the Johannesburg Water Company, who was running it from 2001 to 2005, actually said that it would be foolish to promote conservation among those that were actually paying their bills. And so wealthier people were free to have pools, gardens, fountains, baths. There was sort of no limit as long as they were paying, at least in theory, because the city also admitted that one of the worst debtors were actually government and institutional people, and so there was no discussion of implementing any sort of prepaid water meters to them. And so you see sort of this discrepancy that the justification, it's not actually about water consumption, it's actually about wasting water that they're not getting paid for. And so, in actuality, Johannesburg in 2000, they were in a financial crisis, and so this change in water policy was a part of this broader scheme of how do we figure out how to sort of get out of this financial problem. And basically the idea was, we want to encourage these people who aren't paying for water to use it less while allowing these people who will pay for water to use as much as they want, and that way we can sort of get money from it. And so it becomes, you know, not, the water is seen then as a social, it's not seen as a social good, it's seen as an economic good and a way to get money for the city itself. So I hopefully have shown the problem that progressive realization has in sort of implementation of rights, specifically the right to water. I mean, it applies to all economic, social, and cultural rights, but I wanted to use the right to water because it's so critical and so important to achieving any other rights and to living any sort of dignified life that I think most people would agree that, you know, providing this basic minimum is something important that we want to do. But this case shows that by allowing progressive realization to attach to a right like water, it enables governments and judges to sort of get around these obligations by claiming issues with, you know, resource limitations, and to say, you know, it's not our job to figure out exactly how to provide this basic minimum, and, you know, who are we to say what that is, and so it just enables them to sort of get around these obligations, and it also disenfranchises the people that should be having those rights. So moving forward, I think that the sustainable development goals or whatever comes out really need to look at the human rights framework and how it impacts the law on the ground floor, because like I said, there's no international body for people to appeal to. The people that gave the suit, it's not like they can turn to another court necessarily and have their rights, you know, immediately realized. And so we need to focus more on what is actually happening on the ground. I mean, a lot of times there are a lot of, you know, NGOs and people that are working to advance water rights, but that, while it sort of is a top-down approach, the progressive realization prevents a bottom-up approach of empowering and enabling citizens to hold their governments accountable when they can kind of hide behind that. And so other issues are figuring out, are there other rights that this would apply to? I know maternal care, there were two cases, I think, in Brazil and Uganda that came out, they were basically the same facts, and they came out completely differently, with one court saying, look, it's limited resources, it's not for me to figure out, you know, how those resources should be used, and another court saying, this is a right in the Constitution that you didn't provide. And so that's one thing moving forward, and figuring out, you know, obviously there are a lot of countries that have resource limitations, so we just want to make sure that it's actually resource limitations that is providing, that's the reason that they can't provide these rights fully, and then figure out some way to sort of engage the global community on these obligations. And again, that's not new. In the 1977 resolution, it said that there are countries that are in a position to provide assistance, and so they should be able to, and there needs to be a development of some international mechanism where we can sort of have a global community effort for those who can't provide it themselves. And so, happy to take any questions after. Thanks.
Thank you. And if our panelists will come up, we can take questions. Sorry. Questions?
I had a question about the one thing, the relative that has triggered a number of reports compared to the developed countries.
Yep.
Do you think that is related to, or could be related to, the fact that developing countries are getting funding from foreign donors, from other governments, so they have to pay for it, as opposed to developed countries that,
right. No, I think that's a good question. And when I saw those results, my first gut reaction was that, and in addition to what the data was kind of telling us, that developed countries sort of took their water and sanitation for granted, saying everybody's fine, whereas in developing countries there is a clear issue. But you do raise, I think it's an interesting question, but I haven't really thought about that connection with assistance and cooperation. What I can tell you is that what we found is that developing countries also talk about assistance and cooperation received from foreign donors a lot more than developed countries do. So there might be something there that's worth exploring. Yeah, thanks.
Ben? So it seems like all three presentations are in some ways talking about accountability for implementation. And one way you can do it is litigation, is through reporting to treaty bodies, and a third way is through a framework of federal global health. But it seems like everyone's concern here is that in some ways either the organs that people are reporting to can't handle the data, or the accountability mechanism is not fully considering rights-based obligations. And in some ways speaks to the framework of federal global health proposal, that there's a lot of incentive in looking toward the existing human rights system in order to assess the implementation of rights. But this presentation shows that sometimes those human rights organs are really bad at it. So my question is, what role can international health organizations like the WHO play in assessing the data to see whether in this case, the correct amount of water meets international guidelines, or to better understand how the data on health match up with our international standards?
Well, there has been some discussion around the framework convention, at least, in having the WHO take the lead on this. However, there has also been a lot of concerns raised that the WHO, as it's presently constituted, is unable to really take a lead because it is too, how can I express this nicely, too dependent on certain countries, certain interests, and probably unable at this point to take an independent stance that would need to be taken. So that, although there's discussion around it, it hasn't really gone much further than sort of the basic. Well, this would be one body that could kind of lead the charge and would be administrative body for a framework convention. But it looks like the WHO is not really, unless we make some changes in the WHO, it's not really able to do that. Can you think of other? Are there other bodies that might?
My perspective wasn't whether WHO should take the lead, but much like the UN Office of the High Commissioner is responsive for all of these external committees, but the committees are themselves independent, whether WHO could house a set of independent monitors the way it has for maternal and child health.
Okay.
I'd also like to say, I think one thing that would be helpful is getting some determination of what the minimum core for a lot of these rights look like. I mean, I think when you have this general idea of like the right to water, you have a right to a house, you have a right to health, it becomes easier for people to sort of say, what does that exactly mean? What, you know, and in a lot of case law, a lot of, you know, judiciaries reject that because they're like, well, you know, that has to be changed depending on the country, depending. So it's just more about figuring out what's reasonable, and then it falls back onto, well, we're limited resources, so. And so I think it shouldn't be that tricky to figure out what actually is, you know, the minimum amount of water that, you know, is necessary, or at least some close-ish range, or I think, you know, providing some fundamental minimal course for a lot of these rights would help.
I guess my concern is that would create a very minimalist view of rights, that you just need to meet the minimum floor and then you're done, as opposed to trying to create, which is what I think I understand you're doing, a more justiciable sense of progressive realization, which helps it create a maximum rights rather than a minimum.
I think the problem is right now so many people aren't even getting what a minimum would be, and so you want to at least have a starting point with that. You know, I mean, there's so many people that would be more than happy, and you can make such a drastic improvement if you did give them some minimum floor, and the more fluctuation you have with that, I think it makes it easier for people to sort of say, well, it's just, you know, because I think it's this and you think it's that, who's to say that, you know, we can't have some global standard then for that and everybody then is left to sort of figure it out on their own.
Yep.
Yeah, I really appreciate where the conversation was going, because that's why I was telling you, we just maybe a different frame of discussing the entire issue, because I think when we're talking about what's justiciable and what's, what human rights are and how global they are, or what minimum core we should consider, I think we also have to remember to bring things to the table, like the cultural background, the authoritative nature, the system that we're used to dealing with, you know, from the past, the role of history, and things of that nature. Bring it to the conversation, and so we're talking about developed versus developing nations, so people have a very, the government has a very strong opinion about organizations like WTO, WHO, UN, etc., and really how to have those conversations. Well, I love your example in South Africa, because that puts it in context, and that's what each, you know, state, each nation has to do, is put it in context, and that's not what I think we've been able to do well.
My name is Patty. I work for an international reproductive rights organization called IPAC. And to fill in some of the maternal mortality cases, the Uganda case was a national level case that went, I think, to the Supreme Court or the Constitutional Court and failed to have standards around the right to maternal health care, where the Brazil case was Elaine versus Brazil at the CEDAW committee, so that was an international human rights case. And just to say, I mean, in terms of accountability, there were different judgments, but the result at this time is not any different in that in Brazil right now, there still isn't the right to maternal health. Women can't get maternal health care necessarily in the way that the CEDAW committee said they should. Just to say, I mean, when I think of accountability, I think the standards are so little and the judgments are such a little piece of the story. It's bringing the judgment of the CEDAW committee, for example, to negotiations between communities and facilities, health facilities or communities and governments at the state level. So just that the standards are really just sort of a hook or a way to engage governments. And not, it's not the end of the story. It's not that the government, therefore, you know, has to implement the decision, but rather it's something for advocates and activists at all levels to continue to push. And they're important, but they're just sort of the first step in the continuing promotion of human rights.
I mean, I agree, maybe I shouldn't try to mention too much about maternal cases, but I don't know sort of briefly about them. But yeah, I mean, I think, to have a court ruling that says your rights are violated and then nothing done is obviously not great. But it's still, and like you said, it's a part of the process. It still enables somebody to say, okay, look, this is not being done. If we can't appeal to our government to do it, maybe there is some international body or somebody else that we can, you know, something. But at least then we have tangible, someone we can pin to that says our rights are not being fulfilled the way that they should be.
Yeah.
Cheryl O'Connor. I don't think you did, but I was one of the co-authors of a resolution before the APHA about the UN's role in tolerance and hate. And I think I was like, I came because I saw the title of your resolution, and I was like, oh, great, it's going to be about the UN being humble. And instead, it was the reverse, right? The countries get problems with the UN, so they have water sanitation infrastructure, which we know maybe is like awful. And we also were reading about Katrina Albuquerque and her quotes. I think it's interesting what you were saying, like within the UN, there's an independent sort of human rights body, and then she was very critical of the UN's response to Haiti after the tolerance. So I just don't know though, like what does that mean? I'm curious, do you guys know anyone here? Because like, so she's making very critical statements, like Yale's Global Health and Justice, you know, Institute can come up with a big report to the UN, you know, really making a mistake here. But then like the UN doesn't have to respond to them, or like there's some way that the UN is like ever gonna respond to these comments, or I don't know. So far they haven't shown up to like court cases or I don't know, just is there like a mechanism for that? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it's a good question. This is sort of like the underlying assumption that we approach this project with is that these committees are sort of the primary way of holding states to account. But at the same time, I almost view it as a two-way street, I guess, that we need states to report the right things, and we need the committees to know what they're looking for. That's why we keep pushing that whole universal indicators thing. But I also feel like you're talking about like committees within the U.S. system and General Assembly versus you know what the states are saying in General Assembly versus what committees are just saying sort of on the side. And at least what we can infer from our results is that maybe there's something to having broader state involvement in coming up with these definitions and scopes and contents of these rights. We saw a greater increase in the depth of reporting after the UN 2010 General Assembly resolution. So,
I would just add that all of these approaches to accountability seem to have drawbacks. Litigation has the drawback that you only get one shot at it. So Patty's picked up on this idea that you bring a court case, nothing happens, then what? Whereas some of the reporting guidelines, there's sort of this cyclical process. So you keep coming back every 5 years now. And every 5 years you get a sense longitudinally of progressive realization. But at the same time, what both of these lack is what I think this question is about, is how we hold the UN accountable in national courts. And so the UN doesn't have an internal body that holds itself accountable, nor do national courts have the authority to sue the UN. So that seems to be where this falls in. So is the UN responsible for color and hate? Yes. Can you sue the United Nations when it does something bad? Okay. So that sort of falls through everything. Like, these are all responses to when the state does something bad, when the UN does something bad. We're sort of at a loss.
Sure. I think that should part of me feels like then our mission as we're interested in global health rights is almost to lift up the tools that we currently have instead of necessarily creating an entirely new invention. Okay. I definitely utilize some of these tools, not in reports and things like that. Maybe we need to just focus on ensuring that everyone knows how to use these tools effectively and working on increasing acceptance of international law in countries like the U.S. That's sort of my pondering. Do we create a whole new thing that might also be somewhat
more? Well, that's the hope is that there won't be, which is the whole idea behind creating. I guess my thought on that is that it can be done simultaneously. I think there's not enough out there that's specific enough or detailed enough about health as a right. You've got it kind of here and there and everywhere, sort of generally, but you don't have a single sort of document that brings it all together. Now, a lot of these, at the Framework Convention, I believe, will end up content-wise reflecting a lot of what's out there, but at least bringing it together in a sort of uniform system. And also, I certainly believe that some of the monitoring and accountability mechanisms are going to be what we're using right now anyway, because that's what we, you know, it's kind of hard to reinvent the wheel sometimes in many ways. I'm hoping that there we can add to it, but I don't really see it as completely different, I guess I would say. It's just in addition, if you will, and also, you know, making a standardized attempt to define and to enforce the right to health.
And we were kind of whispering on the side there. I think what each of our presentations sort of pointed out, like, there's no silver bullet to any of this. And, you know, like Michelle just mentioned, that our perspective is indicators, making sure we're standard and comparable. And combining that approach with what we've heard today, maybe that's, you know, we can't sort of one piece of the puzzle, maybe all of us together might support each other for that way.
I have time for one more question if there are any. Wonderful. Oh, sure.
Just a question for Matthew. I'm just curious to know about the local level response to the introduction of framework. What is the local understanding of what is right or not? How do you
the people who got the meters? There's a bit of a discrepancy from what I've read. I mean, some of the people that were in the suit said the water system, it had three different levels, but people in the poor areas were not eligible for the level of credit payment, and so they had two other levels, but there was a discrepancy over whether they were actually given those. A lot of that said, they just came in and took what was already there and put in these meters. And so, but then on the other side, the city's saying, no, we have these hearings and we, you know, do public forums and educated, went around, talked to everybody and told them if they missed it or didn't understand it, there's nothing we can do. So there's sort of some discrepancy as to what people really knew or didn't know about the water. I mean, what they were doing or not doing wrong before, but to me it seems pretty clear that it wasn't like they were just trying to figure out a better way to run their water system. They're trying to figure out a way to get more money into the city's account.
Thank you. Thank you to all our panelists.